This edition of Pit Stop welcomes Brian from Bad Art Nice Watch. Brian told me he wanted to interview me many moons ago. I told him I'd be more than happy to do it, and though it took several months, I'm glad we were able to make it happen. This interview took place only a day before posting and on the heels of his return from New York City, where he was plucked to create some art at none other than the grand opening of the new IWC boutique on Madison Avenue. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and as always, thank you for listening. Well, listen, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this and putting forth the idea as well in order to do so.
Absolutely. I'm jazzed. Yeah, I'm glad that we got a chance to talk about that. God, what was that? September, October?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I saw you in November, right?
Yeah, it was Unlikely Professionals. I can't remember what month that was.
Yeah, it's November.
Okay.
Which, you know, is 6 months ago now.
Wow, yeah.
Man, so in theory, if we were to do it again, we're halfway there.
Yeah. Which I imagine we will.
It's just crazy. Yeah. No, I definitely want to. And actually within the next couple months is usually when I would like reach out to, you know, Red Bar and or Derek to sort of take a temperature, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can speak from the Red Bar side. We would love to have you back. So.
Oh, cool, man. Yeah. No, thanks. It's always super fun for me just because, I mean, obviously I get to see my family and like just roam around Raleigh and just constantly see something different that's changed that I didn't see the time before, you know, something like that.
Yeah,
it's always intriguing in that sense.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're an honorary member of our club, so.
Well, thank you. No, it's great. I love all of your get togethers and, you know, the Instagram and everything. It's great.
So how's everything going with you?
It's good. Gearing up for a trip to LA tomorrow to pick up some product. Seeing some friends, kind of meetings and stuff tomorrow. And then Tuesday, putting that inventory on the website. So that's exciting.
Nice.
I mean, I guess I could tell you. It doesn't really matter. Actually, I probably should tell you because of when this is coming out. This is coming out on Tuesday. So,
oh, well, perfect.
Yeah, so basically what's hitting the site now is some replenishment of some black stuff, some white stuff, the garage color, and then also introducing the XK sweatshirt in blue scuro, which is that sort of navy blue color that I have not yet done in the XK. So excited for that one for sure.
That'll be awesome.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. I'm just selfishly wanting it myself. So.
Well, you know, hey, that's the litmus test, right? Like, if you're going to buy it, that's the way you know it's going to sell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always said with just Standard H in general, right, is that, like, as long as I like it, there will always be at least one customer. And God knows if I like it, there's bound to be somebody else that can appreciate it as well.
Yep.
So that was genuinely my approach to starting this company of like, make the stuff that I would like to wear personally. I mean, it's already kind of a difficult time trying to be a mind reader with regards to who likes certain colors or should I do this in every color or should I not, or should I be restrictive or, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, that makes sense. And I think you're absolutely right. If you would buy it, then you know that you're going to sell one and your tastes have not, I don't think, led you astray yet. So,
well, thanks.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of that too, like, you know, with the Willie shirt jacket, I've told the story before, is that like, it's based on a vintage kind of military shirt jacket that I personally had and couldn't get again, you know? So it's not that I created the shirt jacket, you know, clearly. And, you know, it is not that I created the military shirt jacket, clearly.
Yeah.
But doing it in my fabric and adding the pockets on the inside, which my vintage one did not have, that sort of makes it my own and unique to Standard H.
Yep. Awesome. Well, I know that when we spoke back in November, I had so many questions because I think we were talking about this, you know, when I was in college, I had done t-shirt design for my, you know, fraternity and other organizations that I was in. And I've been fascinated with the idea of starting a clothing company. And I just remember being so excited to pick your brain on, you know, how does this stuff work? How did you get into this? What does that mean? What is that? And so I know a lot of this was just self-serving for me of just wanting to pick your brain, understanding. I mean, I've heard a little bit of the Standard Age story of, you know, with the van and everything and what your initial vision of this was, but I really wanted to kind of pull back and get a deeper dive, obviously not naming names of producers. And I know a lot of that stuff is tightly, you know, guarded, rightfully so, but kind of just understanding more about how it works, because I know you were talking about, you know, this is not a drop ship. You're not, you know, picking a fabric, or you're not picking a shirt off of, you know, someone else's sales floor or manufacturing floor. And you're doing your own fabric blends. You're got your own, I can't remember all the terms, but something about your own fit, your cut. So I wanted to kind of get a little bit deeper understanding and ask you some questions with regards to that. That was cool.
Yeah, no, 100%. I'm glad that we're doing this, because a lot of times I fault myself for not being as articulate as maybe I need to be with describing why it's different, how it's different. So this is the exact platform. Now, I also realize that I am the major point of distribution of this conversation. So, yeah. I might be preaching to the choir in certain respects, but yeah, no, let it rip. Like,
yeah. Well, because in honestly,
you well, know, actually, what you let think- me sort of interrupt you. Sorry, is that
yeah.
I'm actually doing both. So the screen printed t-shirts with my logo on them, that yeah. is a bought blank.
Oh, okay.
So, and those are the only shirts that are that way. Now, without naming names and such, I could tell you who I use, but it won't yeah. really help the layperson in, you mm-hmm. know, Charlotte or Minneapolis or whatever. I buy a blank t-shirt, which I like. So maybe my advice is, if you want to do screen printed shirts, find a shirt you like and buy that shirt, right?
Yep. Yep.
Then take it to your local screen printer, because that's exactly what I do. My local screen printer just so happens to be the one that does it for Quiksilver and Billabong and all the rest of this. So
nice.
I trust their work.
Yeah.
they've been in the business for 40 years. So, you know, it's not some guy in his garage with just like, you know, one squeegee doing one mm-hmm. shirt at a time, you know? So it's one of those things where that I am fortunate to be subjected to. And honestly, yeah. even being in San Diego, I still am jealous of the companies that are literally based in LA or literally based in New York, because they have that community immediate to them. And, yeah. Typically the communities also of like-minded people. So there's far more people like me in LA, mm-hmm. in New York, that are not here in San Diego. So yeah. it's a struggle from that perspective.
Yeah. You know? Well, that makes sense. I mean, well, we can get into it later, but you know, I was just up in New York and seeing how quickly you get in touch with people who have, to your point, like cool creatives who are doing cool things and want to collaborate with other cool creatives who are doing cool things
yeah.
and how easily being in a place like that just grants you so much more access than Raleigh, North Carolina, or I mean, even San Diego. I'm sure you're going to have a lot more connections than probably I do in terms of some of the stuff, but a lot of the realms that, you know, you and I orbit are, it would be nice to be in one of those larger markets where you can really talk to some of those people who are doing some stuff.
Couldn't agree more.
So I know, obviously, you correct me if I'm wrong, but how did you come from state, right? You went to NC State?
I did, yeah.
So how did you end up from NC State landing in California? What was that transition? How did you get over to the West Coast?
Since I was 15 years old, I wanted to basically leave Cary, North Carolina. I don't know. I think it was through snowboarding. I was like, good God, I want to move to Colorado. And it was Colorado. You can ask my mom. It would almost frustrate her. Fine, go ahead and go. You know, that kind of thing. For like 10 years, all I would talk about is Colorado, Colorado, Colorado. One of my best friends, Steven, ended up going to CU in Boulder. So I even during college got to go visit Boulder, which I've always joked is 27 square miles surrounded by reality. but yeah, it's one of those things where I was just obsessed with the mountains. you know, that kind of thing. I think one of the years I actually went to LA with my then girlfriend for spring break. Like, who goes to Los Angeles for spring break in college?
Yeah, nobody.
So, so we went with another couple to visit her mutual friend or whatever. And I fell in love with Los Angeles. I was like, oh my God, like I'm going to live here one day. And I was like, I don't know, 21, I think at the time. I'll skip forward 6 years and not bore everybody with my personal life, but basically was running a retail store in Raleigh. I was just already in the fashion world from because of that.
Yeah.
And I was running a multi-brand boutique, Diesel, French Connection, Ted Baker. And the design for, like, my desire to move to LA was really to be an outside sales rep for a clothing company or work at a showroom.
Okay.
Well, it was 2007, and knocking on the door was a bunch of financial hoopla. So,
yep.
Needless to say, I finally just bit the bullet because trying to find a job in Los Angeles living in Raleigh was like impossible.
Yeah.
So I lied to my parents. I told them I had a job in Los Angeles. I packed up my stuff. I drove across the country in 9 days. I stayed with friends every night except for one night in Baton Rouge. But luckily I had friends all across the lower part of the states and could crash for free. And yeah, so I pulled into LA, I think it was April 23rd, 2007, and immediately hit Craigslist. I was knocking on doors for jobs. I was trying to work retail. And finally landed on a job that was like basically marketing PR and then sort of like a car broker for the movie industry. So I was placing cars in TV shows, commercials. I did the MTV Music Awards, the show 24, like all kinds of stuff. So I was placing cars for that. And then the writer strike, the original one, or one of the original ones in 2008-09, laid me off. So then I got back into retail as a stock supervisor of all things. I mean, I had managerial experience, but then became basically a stock supervisor for James Peirce and worked for him for the better part of 5 years. And he's who moved me to San Diego to run the store down here.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I ended up in San Diego.
Wow. So it was always kind of still connected to the fashion world.
100%. Like I never, what's funny is like the car thing was kind of exciting just because of the projects that I was placing cars in.
Mm-hmm.
The actual job itself wasn't that sexy. It's a lot of dealing with art directors that want everything yesterday and they want it for free.
Yep.
So it was just this constant push and pull of negotiating car rates and, oh, well, can we get it delivered for free? And I'm like, well, it's not free to us, you know? So that's every industry, I guess, but, that's how it all happened. And for a quick blip on my radar, I did sell Audis and Porsches in like 2004.
Okay.
So I've always been obsessed with cars as well, just since I was a kid, but never that like technically minded. I don't come from a car family. My dad was not a car guy. I never learned to change the oil when I was 16, you know, like things like some gearheads are like really into the quite literally the nuts and bolts of cars. And
yeah,
I was just never subjected to it. And I didn't do that deep dive. I was too busy with baseball in my free time, basically, which then became golf. But anyway,
nice
side note.
I understand that one.
Yeah.
I understand that one.
Yeah.
So you get to San Diego, you're working for another company. I'm sure you had this little kernel of an idea of Standard H brewing in the back of your head. Walk me through the initial ideation of this is what I want to do while still maintaining another job. And then also, what was the catalyst to say, okay, it's time to close that other door and jump, you know, face first into this next endeavor?
Really good line of questioning. Where should I start? Let's see. Okay. So basically I had left James Peirce for Gucci because they offered me $13,000 a year to have less of a title. So I went to a bigger store, got demoted by title, but had more responsibility and got paid more. All I saw was money at the time. So I was like, of course, you know, and Gucci is a very reputable brand. I went there. Though I hear the company is very different today, the corporate culture then I absolutely hated. I worked there for a year and a half or 2 years. I think I was there for 2 years and I was looking for a job for 18 months. So within 6 months, I was like, I got to get the hell out of here. You know what I mean? Yeah. In hindsight, it's fine. I like met some great people, still friends with a lot of them, but the company at large, which again is not like this today, not my vibe. All the while, I've been wanting to start my own clothing company since, I don't know, high school or college. And while I was at NC State, I took entrepreneurship, and your final exam, if you will, was writing a business plan. Mm. So I was obsessed with snowboarding, as I mentioned before. I was obsessed with, you know, like the X Games and stuff like that, which I ended up working for the summers. So I worked for the X Games, I think, for 2 or 3 years. And I wanted to start like an action sports line of I wanted to start another Billabong, basically.
Yep.
But that was in college. Fast forward to 2015, I'm working for Gucci. My style's maybe a little different, a lot different. Saw what James Peirce had done. But I kind of wanted to do it for like cars and surfing and specifically cars, I guess. Did a quick Google search, because my idea was to have a Volkswagen Vanagon gutted and made into a mobile store. In that Google search, in the images, I found the shift gate pattern. Oh, wow, this thing shifts on a standard H. So I was like, standard H is cool. Quick Google search for the URL. It was taken by Standard Hydrogen Corporation. That's why I have a hyphen in my URL. Yeah, but the LLC was available, so that was great. I will sort of interrupt myself by saying when I was 29, getting laid off and going back to work in retail as a stock supervisor, I think I was 28, actually, I'd opened the store in Malibu. It was great. James Peirce, great company, super fun. But I'd always thought, like, I really wanted to make six figures by the time I was 30. Well, I wasn't there. I wasn't even close. And I basically hired a career counselor at the advice of my dad. Because I was like kind of depressed, to be honest with you. I was just like, dude, I'm not going anywhere. When I was living in Raleigh, I was like, meh, I don't really love it here. You know, no offense to Raleigh, of course, you know, or anything like that. But it was just kind of like, I knew a lot of people in Raleigh and I felt very insulated, which was nice. It was like a warm embrace, a warm hug. But like, I'm an adventurer by nature and I like to be uncomfortable. And like, I really wanted something big. I'm an extrovert. I love meeting new people all the time. Retail is great for that. But that's also why I wanted to be an outside sales rep. I wanted to travel. I wanted to go. I wanted to do. I wanted to meet people and sell stuff that I really liked and things like that. But I wasn't doing that at 28, 29. So I hired this career counselor. And basically he was like, the advice that I think a lot of career counselors offer, and that's, if money were no object, what would you do? And I was like, well, I mean, I answered him in 2 seconds. I was like, I'd have my own clothing brand. And he's like, well, then go do that. I was like, do you have any earthly idea how much that would cost? And he goes, well, then borrow the money. I was like, but I hate the feeling like I owe people anything. Like all my vendors get paid either credit card immediately or a check immediately. I've never done the net 30 thing with anybody. And they love me for that. Because I hate feeling like I owe anybody anything. Like I just don't like it. You can owe me. It's fine. And that's not like a leveraging technique that I don't care. It's that you'll pay me. You know, I trust people. Mm-hmm. But I just don't like that feeling for myself. So, but he flipped the script on me. And again, I'm 29 years old. He said, well, Wesley, what I can offer you now is, do you invest your money in the stock market at all, ever? Like, be it your 401k, do you pick the stocks and yada, yada, yada? And I'm like, well, I mean, I do to some degree. You know, I don't make a huge amount of disposable income, so I'm not investing a ton as it is, but I do have 401k and I, you know, do make certain choices. And he's like, well, why would you look at yourself as anything other than a rich guy's stock? So you are the stock in this case. And the rich guy with plenty of disposable income is betting on you to succeed. Now, would you bet on yourself? I said, well, of course, because I know my work ethic. I know my creativity. I have a vision. And he said, well, great. So what's the problem? I was like, well, I mean, finding the guy who's willing to invest in you is a problem. Like, I can, I don't know. Then write a business plan. Well, I don't know. That then scared me, because then I felt like I sort of came up, I don't know, call it an excuse. It's very possibly labeled as an excuse. Okay. But the line that I told myself in my head basically was, the day you take money is the day you have to answer questions. You know, shares dispersed amongst shareholders and stuff, that doesn't exist in Standard H, right? Basically, I just decided to sit on my hands. And I did that until I was 35, when I was working for Gucci. And finally was like, you know, the brand doesn't have to do $1 million in a month on day one, you know, or like on month one, you know, it's like, wouldn't doing anything be better than doing nothing? Like, and that's just kind of where I came from. And I was just like, get off your ass, dude. And like, just what can you do? Like, what can you do? You don't have $1 million in the bank. Fine. Do you have $150? Do you have $1,500? Like, how much can you spend and or risk, if you will? And that's why I made the hat as the first product. Because I could buy a dozen hats. And I could have some patches made.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go to my local embroiderer, much like my local screen printer, which came later in the story. And I could do this. And I could sell them for X times whatever my costs were. And I walked into my local surf shop. And JP, God bless him, he was like, dude, I'll buy some hats from you. So he bought like five. And, you know, so I just basically made 12, sold those, made, I don't know, 24, sold those, made 36, you know, and I just kept doing that. And then, but then it was like, oh, well, I should probably make some t-shirts too. And then it's like, once you do that, it's like the startup cost of that. There's minimum orders for t-shirts, not from the people that sell me the t-shirts. There's actually a minimum order from the screen printer. So that's something about this business that a lot of people don't think about. And that's also why I produce here in LA, is not just for quality control, not just to keep our neighbors employed, not just for all those positivity type of approaches. But if I tried to do this in Asia, I would have to order 3,000 t-shirts, not 300, you know, and I couldn't afford it. So
yeah,
it's just a mouse on a wheel at this point of just like reinvestment, reinvestment, reinvestment. Now I did this while working retail.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was done in the evenings. A lot of it was done on the weekends, like going into that surf shop, stuff like that. Now that surf shop since closed. I went to another very famous one in La Jolla, sold hats to them. They sold out immediately. I went back to sell them and they were like, oh no, we're good. I don't get it. And it wasn't the owner, it was the buyer who said that, but not throwing shade, but it was the buyer also had his own side hustle company. And I think there was maybe something to do with that. Even though his side hustle was on the side of him managing that store. I don't know. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You left a lot of wisdom there on the table. But so what was the catalyst then for you to leave Gucci? You're selling these hats. You're selling some t-shirts. At what point do you say, this is enough? This is a proven thing. I can leave Gucci behind and do Standard H full time.
Well, it wasn't until like 6 years after that. So I started this in 2015. I was there until August of that year. And then I got hired for a division of Titleist Golf, and I was working for Titleist for 2 years, and then basically got recruited by Allen Edmonds to open the Allen Edmonds boutique here in San Diego, which is where I was leading up into the pandemic. And yeah, worked there until I was furloughed for the pandemic, and then, you know, calling a spade, I basically got paid for a year on my manager's salary to sit at home. So I dumped all my money into production and started finally doing what I, what we in the industry call cut and sew, which may have been the phrase you were looking for earlier.
That was it.
So basically what that means is my silhouette effectively, like I can determine literally the dimensions and where it gets stitched, and it's my product. And a lot of that came from using shirts that I liked the fit of to base my sort of silhouette on.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of side panel gusset, as I've, I think, mentioned on the website, is actually borrowed from an REI jacket that I had years and years and years ago. And the reason why that panel was there is because it was meant for ice climbing, and your arms are always up. And so if that panel extends down, there's no lift in the garment. So I was thinking cars, travel, air travel, loading the overhead. We've all had somebody's belly button flash us sitting in an aisle seat, right? So that's literally why I did that. And then the pocket was like, okay, I'm not really interested in an ornamental pocket. I don't really care that a pocket is just there, you know, like, I want something more than a pocket. You know, I want it to actually serve a purpose and be utilitarian. And so, again, travel. Well, what else do you have? Like, you're at the airport, you're seeing this guy fumble around with a stroller and two kids, and he's got his passport in his mouth. So I was like, well, I should baseline have it accommodate a passport, which, as it happens, God forbid your ticket ever get changed and you're handed a printed ticket, it's about the same width. So it would fit your boarding pass and your passport in the pocket. And I hate putting my sunglasses hanging from my neck of my shirt, because sometimes it'll stretch it out depending on the shirt. But I was like, well, with a deeper pocket, I could also bend over, tie my shoe, and my glasses won't fall out if your shirt's fitted.
Right? Yeah.
Like if you're wearing it, like, according to how it's designed to fit. And so there was like all these ancillary benefits of making the pocket that size. So that's why I launched with the Avant T. Avant meaning the Audi, Avant, the wagon, perfect daily driver, quote, with ideal utility. So then I was like off to the races with, which is all concepts that I thought about leading up to this, like long before, you know, like naming the products after cars, calling the colors after automotive paint colors, and or like automotive inspiration. All of those things that, like, I worked for far too many brands that used periwinkle as their color, or cloud, or sky blue. It's like, well, I can call these colors whatever I want, so why don't I just match them to the cars that I love so much? And that's literally how that happened.
Yeah. I mean, unless you're colorblind, you're going to see what it is. So you might as well have a fun name for it.
Well, yeah. Well, thanks. You know, thanks for noticing.
Yeah. So you have started Standard Agent Earnest. You are no longer working for Allen Edmonds.
Right.
You're now able to do your own cut and sew, now that we all know what that term means.
Right, right.
You've based it off of sizes that you like. Talk to me about the fabric selection, the material selection, the thing that besides your silhouette really makes it Standard H, because I have to imagine you have every possible variation of cotton, cotton blends, all kinds of stuff. So how do you go about picking the material that you want?
Two things. One, learned, I always joke, I got my PhD in t-shirts at James Peirce. He's very well known for his t-shirts. He's also very well known for a really soft hand. But he's also very known for a thin t-shirt. And I saw that the thinner t-shirts get holes in them over time. Personally, though, I'm not like, I'm not body dysmorphic, but I also know that I'm not a supermodel. So I find And I also appreciate just heavy things. I like something with structure. I like a thicker garment. I like a heavy sweater. I like a car door that's, there's a thud. I don't like a ping. I mean, everything. I love heavy shoes. I like just my golf clubs are arguably heavy. As far as a swing weight goes. I don't know. It's just what I like. And
I'm with you. It drapes nicer, in my opinion.
Well, and here's the thing. Unless you're shaped like an upside down Dorito, like, and everything just drapes on you like a supermodel.
Mm-hmm.
I find that these actually make men look better. It makes you look like you maybe have more of a chest than you do. Mm-hmm. Gets away from the dad bod thing, you know? And there's nothing wrong with having a dad bod, obviously. As I get older, trust me, I understand how difficult it is to be in shape.
Yep.
And I find that, what, like in sport, what did Deion Sanders say? It's like, if you look good, you play good. If you play good, they pay good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, for me, it was more like, it's also like, if you look good, you feel good. And when you feel good, you play good, you know? And that could go for business. Walking into a sales meeting, you're going to be more confident if you feel good that day. And to me, and I know we're talking t-shirts here, but we are, I mean, there's a psychology behind all this stuff.
Oh yeah.
And like self-respect and in your emotional intelligence of yourself, you know, like how you take care of yourself. I know obviously like mental health's a huge topic these days that I don't know, maybe even in like 2015 wasn't really talked about. But I knew that there's a reason somebody gets up every morning and puts on what they put on. There's a reason. Now, you're either trying to tell the world you don't care or you're trying to tell the world that you do care. I just happen to be the person that I tried to tell myself that I care. And I knew what I felt good in and what I thought made me look better. So easy for a supermodel to design something that looks good. I'm not a supermodel. Thus, like I said, it's like I designed something that at least I feel like it makes me feel good.
Yep.
And rumor has it, my customers are down with it too, which is great. So that's sort of how I chose the thickness of the fabric, and I knew I wanted it to be soft.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, I guess, the answer to the question. Now, I was mentioning the Avant tee earlier. Carrera tee, same thing as the Avant tee, no pocket, right? Perfect daily driver, no utility. But then there's the RS tee, which is almost identical, if not identical, to the James Peirce fabric, basically. And that was a lighter weight body, just like in a GT3 RS. You know, they're a lighter weight car, you know, flowier in the turns. So you could argue that it's a flowier fabric. I mean, I don't want to exhaust people and solicit an eye roll necessarily, but that is sort of the mentality, right? Is that like it's thinner, lighter weight for the gentleman who also likes something a little thinner. But I also exclusively do those shirts in the quote standard H version of a PTS program. So these are the lighter colors, the brighter colors that you would often find in a GT3 RS configuration anyway. So you got Ruby Star, you got Miami Blue. I put in chalk because I was like, all right, somebody's going to want to dial this back, you know? So even me selfishly. And so that's really how the RST was born.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
I love that. So kind of going back to your cut and sew, obviously I have to imagine, well, I know, right? You have a standard size. You picked a shirt that you like the fit of to base your sample off of.
Mm-hmm.
How do you scale that? Because your body type is not the same as everyone else's body type.
Right.
How do you make something for someone smaller than you? How do you make something for someone three times as large as you?
Hmm.
How does that work from a sample size? Because I can't imagine you just 2X it or 3X it or whatever, and it doesn't balloon that way. You have to kind of know, like, oh, the arms need to be this much percentage different, and the body has to be this much percentage different. Like, how does that process work? And do you get to determine that specific to you versus, you know, industry standard or something?
Well, good question, because I just stuck with industry standard. And so whoever the manufacturer is that you hire, they typically have either a pattern maker. Some people do, some people don't, on staff. That pattern maker is also they can or don't, or they could ask you or me or whoever. It's called grading. So it grades from, you know, small to a medium to a large and what have you. And the measurement is literally escaping me. I was like, had you not asked, I could have told you what it is because it's not the same for every size. Right. And actually, if you look, some brands will have like a small, a medium, and then there's a big jump from medium to large and then not quite as big from large to extra large. That's just their, I don't know, customized grading, if you will. Gotcha. They were like, okay, well, the guy who's wearing a medium is probably thinner. The guy who's a large might always think he's a large, so let's make it, you know what I'm saying, that kind of thing. And like, I trust me, I understand fit and size is one of the hardest things, right? Not only is color, but sizing is a very good question. I am currently between sizes in my own brand, which is frustrating. When I started Standard H, I was a stock medium. Now I'm a marge, you know, medium, large. And so, and the reason is are the aforementioned getting older, harder to stay in shape. So
yes,
and traveling a lot and eating on the road and not exercising because I'm go, go, go. Enough with the excuses. I'm at where I'm at, working on it. So the large for me and the medium for me is not going to have like a big jump as you may or may not see in other brands, but industry standard, it's like, I don't know, I think it's like 3/4 of an inch to an inch or something like that, or an inch and an eighth, or, you know, I mean, it's in circumference, right? Or width.
Yep.
And so some people will visit my site and be like, oh my God, well, Wesley, I'm a 40 jacket, but your size says 20. How is that possible? I'm like, well, the t-shirt is laying flat, so it measures 20. But the 40 you're referring to goes, it's a tape that you would run around your chest through a circular approach, not a flat approach. So for those listening, that's the reason. You just multiply by 2, basically.
Yep. It's interesting because I feel like as I've gotten older too, you know, I'm staring at 40 at the moment. I'm not quite there yet, but you kind of just get to a point where you don't care about the vanity sizes anymore, where you're not playing, you're just looking. And now I'm just like, I'm looking at numbers like, okay, is this the circumference that I want, that I know is comfortable to me? I measured a shirt that was a size that I like, and I saw how it fit on me, and I was like, this isn't half bad. So now I know when I'm looking for stuff, like, okay, that's the number I should be looking for, regardless of whatever the tag says. Yes, I may not feel great about myself because it says however many X's or whatever, or, you know, it's not a medium or whatever it could be, but I know that theoretically when I get it, it should be what I want from a fit and a look perspective. So
so you're the one.
So that, to my question, or leading to a question, I know from a watch perspective, I know a lot of your fans are also watch guys.
100%.
You know, we have so many measurements when it comes to watches.
Totally.
You know, what's the diameter? What is the lug to lug? What's the, you know, the lug spacing? Thickness. What is thickness, height, all this kind of stuff. And it's all about trying to make sure it's something that someone will be able to fit into. Without pulling up your website, which I should have had up on a separate monitor, and I don't want to make all these key clicks on my side.
It's totally fine.
What are the measurements that you offer for someone to be able to assess if that piece of, you know, fabric, that garment is going to fit them well?
Three of them. It's width, which is usually give or take an inch below the pit. So what I would say is, if you are looking for a t-shirt on my website and are unsure what size to buy, my advice is to lay your favorite t-shirt down on a table or the floor, measure it about an inch below the armpit, straight across, and see what size that aligns to on my website. Now that's width. I also offer length. I'm 5'10", so I'm not very tall, right? But I don't love really long t-shirts. So there are like the four people in the last 6 years who have been like, your shirts are too short. Or I've had a couple of people, your shirts are too long. I can't help you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If they're too long, hem them, you know, like that's what tailors are for. You know, you'd probably do the same thing with your pants. So, you know, not to cop out, but that's sort of the other approach. And then sleeve length. I'll give you the sleeve length from the shoulder seam to the edge of the shirt sleeve, both for short sleeve and long sleeve, of course.
Nice.
And that's from the shoulder seam, not in the traditional dress shirt sense, which I believe is measured from the middle of the back to the edge of the sleeve. So it's different in that way.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Do you do sleeve opening? Because I know that's also, I'm thinking of shirts that have fit poorly in the past, and even it may have some measurements that look good. Maybe the sleeve's a little longer than you want it to be, but it's also like gaping and you look like you're wearing your dad's shirt.
Right.
How do you go about choosing, you know, whether you're a buff guy or you're not? How do you get that measurement right?
Yeah, you know, okay, so there's a couple of things here, which I'm glad you asked, because I don't think I've ever talked about this. I do not give you the sleeve opening. No reason other than I just haven't. But the way I also tailored my fit from day one was that I personally feel like the best looking t-shirts fit almost similar to the best looking polos. And traditionally, a polo fits you mid-bicep or just a touch longer than mid-bicep. You know, if you're in shape and you feel good about yourself, you know, that's going to look really good, you know, as far as like just exposing just enough arm to where you're not like, I don't know, trying to look cocky, I guess. But like, that was the approach. And so my sleeves are nice and fitted, like they're supposed to be. But this is something I've also not talked about. The shirts themselves, though they don't have elastic in them, there is an elasticity to cotton, just like your jeans. When you try on your jeans, like if they're 100% cotton jeans, you'll find that as you wear them, they'll expand a little bit. It's the same thing with your t-shirt. So what I have often said is like, if the shoulders look good and they're like, maybe you've just been really hard in the gym and your arms are huge, just stick your hand. I know this is audio only, but like stick your hand while wearing the shirt up the sleeve from your elbow and just like pull the fabric a little bit away from your bicep. If the fit's bothering you, right? Mm-hmm. And me being in between sizes, let me just touch on my own situation. I do the same thing with the body of my shirt sometimes to where I feel great in it all across my chest. I feel great in it with the sleeve, you know, close to my bicep. I feel great around the rib cage. But, you know, my spare tire down by my belt line is not helping, let's say. So what I'll do is I'll just stick the backside of my forearm up through the bottom of my shirt and just push the garment away from my body slightly. Not crazy, because, like, it'll look crazy.
Yeah.
But just a little bit. Just give it that a little bit of elasticity. And if you're worried about stretching it out, like, I know there's somebody listening right now that's being like, well, my other shirts, I don't have to do that for, so I shouldn't have to do it for yours. Like, I get it. I understand. But does the top of your shirt fit as well? You know, whatever. Because everybody's body is different, much to your earlier point, including my own. So I think I'm probably in the minority doing that to the body of my shirts. I think most of my customers are probably fine. You know, who knows? But
I bet you're not in the minority.
but that's what I do. I just kind of give. Now, if I wear a large that day, I don't have to do that because it's a little looser and I'm, you know, whatever. But if I throw on a medium right now, like I got to give like my spare tire some room. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
So those are all just like little tips and tricks that you can then find that medium that won't psychologically disrupt your year that you had to buy a large, you know, just give it a little time. Yep. And by the way, when you wash it, it'll go right back to where it was when you bought it. Right. So nice. Then you'll just have to do that again when you wear it the next time, unless you're like me and you're trying to lose weight. And if you do, congratulations.
Love it. So I want to pivot because I think that answered a lot of my questions on just creation, materials, all that.
Cool.
But I've got some fun stuff that maybe no one's ever asked you before.
Sweet.
So, now having started a clothing brand, how has this changed your consumption of other clothes, whether it is pants, because maybe you're not making pants, or socks, underwear, shoes, more disposable items, or, you know, dress shirts, something like that. How has it changed how you perceive other brands and the qualities that they offer, and how's that changed?
Well, so, okay. Well, there's a few things, obviously. owning my own brand now hasn't really changed my perception of quality. I think working for nearly 20 years in retail did that. So I already had that going in. So I obviously knew that for myself when producing my own stuff is like, if it's not good enough for me, I don't want to sell it. Right. So like the quality thing is almost kind of already done prior to starting. As far as consumption goes, this is probably more to do with age than business ownership, honestly. Chasing trends doesn't interest me. Buy less, buy better is something I just learned years ago. And I think that was a part of like the blogosphere era of 2008 to 2010, you know, the hashtag menswear.
Yep.
So there's that. So really it was a function of, okay, find one pair of jean and buy two or three of them and then just stick with that. So I'm a double RL jean guy. However, I will say at some point I do want to produce bottoms. Like, little known fact, I actually produce shorts on year one and it's really hard to sell shorts online. But now that I'm at least somewhat established in a certain way, like I feel like I could introduce a bottom and have sort of the A, understanding, and B, trust that it's going to fit well and, you know, all the rest of that. Still, that's a bridge too far right now. I think I still got some time before I start launching shorts and pants because everybody's going to complain about the length, you know, of the shorts and then multiple links, and then it becomes a stock thing. Anyway, I'm getting off track. So the thing is I don't know. I think the fit is really where I'm more picky than I've ever been because of just like, I know what I like because I've had to go through so many iterations and nip and tuck and version one of the Willys and version two of, or, you know, version two of the Targa Florio or like what have you. And so now when I shop other brands, it's like, I kind of know what's going to fit. But with dress shirts, I finally, I was referred to Proper Cloth, which I I've shared before, in New York City. They have two locations, Midtown and Soho. For the price you pay, I mean, I think they're made in the Philippines or Vietnam or somewhere, but the fabrics are great. They'll use Thomas Mason fabrics, which J. Crew uses historically. A lot of brands use it, frankly. I mean, you're talking anywhere from $125 to $250 for a shirt that is custom made for your body. Like, you can't beat that. Like, if you go to Turnbull and Asser, like, that's a $600 shirt. You know what I mean? If you go to Charvet, like, that's a $600 shirt. You know, so I've turned to them for, like, my Oxford cloth, for my dress shirts. I've tried some other people, but again, they were, I don't know, $250, $275. Now granted, the other thing is, and this is where it's kind of a struggle too, when you're talking about fashion or watches or anything that you care about detail, is that like, there's so many approaches to it where there's like, we'll get the look for less. Well, if you're like me, you want it to look a certain way. And if you have to have it, you know, quote unquote, a certain way, then you're going to have to pay whatever the price is to make it look that way, right? Like architecture, minimalism, like minimalism in architecture is expensive because it's so easy to see the mistakes. To make a wall completely flat, completely straight, and minimalistic is so hard to do. That's why it's expensive. It's the same in clothes. Like, if you're going to make a silhouette to fit the majority of people as opposed to just you, it's going to be cheaper. It's when you're disrupting manufacturing effectively to fit Brian or to fit Wesley, the disruption's what's expensive, frankly.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, unless you got a robot, which I'm sure they do, which is why it's cheaper, but I have no idea. But... but yeah, I'm more picky on fit, I would say. And just quality of materials, like with shoes and such. Like, I just, buying cheap shoes is just so, it's just not worth it.
Yeah.
Because then your feet end up hurting and, or they're slipping and giving you blisters or they just look like garbage, you know?
Yeah. That's something that I've realized too, is especially for someone whose weight fluctuates like mine.
Sure, your feet do too.
You can always, yeah, but for the most part, you can always, you know, I can set aside, you know, good money for shoes because I know that whether I'm a large or an XL, those shoes are still probably going to fit me.
True.
And so they kind of, they're not as cyclical
yeah.
As other clothing.
And I'll do you one better. When you wear them out, you can get them resold usually.
Exactly.
So the longevity play, you end up getting, I don't know, 2.5 shoes, like depending on what you're wearing from Allen Edmonds, you can resold them at least once, sometimes twice, usually not three, because every time you do it, they're restretching the leather and you're using a mm-hmm. little bit more. So, I mean, unless you're losing weight or something, right? If yeah. you're 300 pounds and suddenly you're 200 pounds, the width will change in your feet, bar none. But
when you were talking about shorts, it actually made me think of just a whole nother question.
Sure.
Which I think it's really important because this is something that I've thought of and would scare me because I've thought about just selling merchandise for my own brand. And one of the big things that has prevented me from wanting to do that is even if I use a dropship, what if someone's unhappy with the clothing? And I know that as someone who is making stuff like you are, I have to imagine returns hurt. And, you know, I know that you stand by your brand and you're going to do what's right for your customer,
yeah.
maintain that. But walk me through what happens when someone says, yeah, I didn't read the thing. I really should have been XL, but I ordered a large. What does the process on your end look like when someone returns something?
Okay, so there's a few things to unpack here, and one of them, and none of this is me bragging, by the way. Like, I'm not. I'm very proud of it, but I'm not trying to gloat. And that is, my return rate of customers is extremely low, and my repeat business is like 70% of my customers.
That's awesome.
Which is very high, and I'm unbelievably grateful for. Which is why those shows like Wind Up or anything are so important, right? Is that like I can show you, you can finally buy it, and that creates a sale later usually, 70% of the time, that I mm-hmm. ordinarily would not have had, right? In theory. When it comes to a return, one thing to note, I lose money on every shipment. Now, if you're buying something for less, if your order is less than $150 on my website, you pay $8 ground shipping. I lose money on that $8 that you're paying. The reason I'm losing money on that, you're like, wait, but I paid you $8. That's because I thought that was like, I don't know, a fair and an unoffensive amount for you to help contribute towards the payment to get it to you. The box, the paper, the sticker on the paper, the handwritten note, the envelope, those are just certain costs that are have nothing to do with the shipping cost. The shipping cost to ship that mm-hmm. is usually above $8 in and of itself, let alone those five other things I just named. So any shipment, even if it's a pound, it could be really lightweight, one t-shirt. I mean, unless you're in San Diego, which is like, I don't know, $6.53 just to ship it, which I'm still losing on because of the box and the paper and the blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
If you live in rural New York or, I don't know, sometimes even like rural anywhere because of the postal way, like UPS doesn't get places certain times,
mm-hmm.
you know, like they got a contract to USPS or whatever. I could pay $16 just on shipping plus the plus, right? So going back to the question, it's $16 to ship it plus, call it $20, right? You bought a $72 t-shirt, but you got it 15% off because it was your first purchase, okay? So basically, you paid $61.20 minus, I guess $61.20 plus $8. So you paid $69.20. But as far as my profitability is concerned, I had the cost of the t-shirt plus, the $20 shipping, the 3% I pay to run your credit card. Then you send it back. Now, this is why exchanges are so much more important than returns, because returns, not only did I just like do all of this, right, and then not get a sale out of it, it's going to cost me another 3% to give you your money back.
Mm. I don't think I realized that.
Short story. Wind up Chicago. A guy buys a watch box from me. It's over $1,000. An hour later, comes back and says, Wesley, you know what? I changed my mind. I don't want that watch box. Now, granted, those are made to order. So you could argue, mm-hmm. Oh, no sweat, Wesley, whatever. Well, because of the value of the watch box and the 3% to run it and the 3% to give it back, the dude cost me $60 for him to change his mind. That's the cost of a t-shirt for me to sell to try to recoup my cost to have my booth at the show. You know what I mean? So, and this isn't me boohooing and being whiny about it, but it's just, there's so many hidden costs behind these things that like not many people think about.
Yeah.
And it's fine. Oh, well, Wesley, you're an online business. Your margins must be insane. No, because my production is so low. It's so expensive to produce here. And it's like, I'm reinvesting in my company, right? Like, I know it looks like I live large all the time, constantly, but the way the business is run is very much with a bootstrap mentality as far as profitability goes.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of it, like the travel costs money. All of this costs money, right?
Yeah.
So yes, I'm doing extremely fun things. I'm meeting amazing people. I'm producing products I'm proud of. But at the end of the day, if I did have a high return rate, my doors would be shut.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's important for people to understand that, because post Amazon, we just live in a try it, buy it, I don't like it, I'm sending it back. And I don't think people realize the impact that that has to a small business compared to a Belk or, you know, Amazon or some other large clothing brand company.
And Brian, all I can say is thank you for bringing it up, because it's like, that's something I don't comfortably talk about because it sounds like I'm bitching and moaning.
Yeah. But if people don't know about it, then they don't know. But now they do.
How do you educate them without it sounding like me complaining, I guess is my point.
Exactly.
You know, like
I don't ask you about it.
Yeah, right. Which I did not prompt you to do, for the record.
Correct. Correct. Well, let me pivot in something else potentially fun. So I have to imagine you were noodling on this idea of Standard Age for a while. You knew you wanted to start with t-shirts, but I have to imagine there's been other products that you have wanted to do. Have you ever had a manufacturer tell you no based on, I want to do XYZ, whether it's through a t-shirt or a jacket or something? They just said, nope, we can't do that.
No.
Okay. That's awesome.
Not yet. No, because because I know the manufacturers that I work with, I know what they do, and I know the brands they do it for.
Yep.
So it's like, I know what their capacities are. And I also know not to ask based on XYZ product. That's why I have a different manufacturer for my jackets than I do my t-shirts. Because I already know the people who make my t-shirts don't make jackets. And it's not because they couldn't figure it out or whatever. I actually don't know the reason, because they're amazing. I mean, they both are. But I do know the people who make my jackets could make my t-shirts. But I'm also, much like I hate like feeling like I owe people something, I hate saying no to people.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that my manufacturer that took me on to make my t-shirts when I was literally like, not that I'm anybody now, but like I was nobody. Like I'd never made anything before. So why in the hell would they work with me? I got so lucky, Brian, I can't tell you. Like, and I'm never going to leave them unless they close their doors.
Yeah.
Because I'm utterly thankful and eternally grateful and indebted to them. Because, by the way, they just so happen to be the best place to get a t-shirt made in America. And I don't say that because of Standard Age. I say that because I've also been in the industry for 20 years, and I know the other brands they've made for, and everybody else would agree with me if I named those brands right now.
Yep.
It's that simple.
Nice. Well, kind of going to my other another question that's kind of similar. This is, I don't know about you, but I love coming up with creative designs, with ideas, and maybe even just kind of brainstorming brands in my head. I put that in air quotes, brands outside of Standard H or outside of Bad Art Nice Watch, whatever it is. Has there ever been a product that you wanted to create, but because you have set up Standard H as slightly automotive, lifestyle, whatever, that it didn't fit your current brand that you said, I'm shelving this idea until maybe I do a different brand or something along those lines? Has there ever been a product that didn't fit the Standard H mold that you want to create?
That's a tough question to answer because I feel like Standard H is such an extension of me that, like, if I, again, we're back to the original point. If I want it, it fits in the brand, you know, which is something I struggle with online. And give me a second here because it's not a straight line conversationally to get you there. Basically, I think of things all the time. Like I'm not really forward facing on my Instagram. I am much more now than I was mm-hmm. 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 6 years ago. Because I never wanted the brand to be about me. Mm-hmm. And my very closest friends have all been like, Wesley, you have to be the face of the brand. People want to see you. They want to hear from you. And it's something I battle every week, every single week. Like my wife will even tell you, like, I hate posing for pictures with her because I hate being on camera. Like it's not because I'll take 700 photos of my wife. But if I'm in the frame, like, it's just, I don't know, man. Like I'd much rather be behind the camera. That and mm-hmm. strangers don't usually take great photos on vacation. Like I'd rather take that photo. So as far as the product is concerned, like I have ideas all day. Like, I mean, honestly, it's been talked about a lot that I've renovated the house we live in. I hand drew our kitchen like on a piece of paper and like gave it to my contractor and said, I wanted it this way. And mm-hmm. I was in here every single day overseeing it, not to micromanage, but just to be like, oh shit, I forgot that detail. Let's do it this way or whatever, you know? So like I have furniture designs in my brain that I would love to bring to the table eventually. And again, this is not me trying to copy James Peirce, but like if he can do it and Rick Owens can do it and Gucci's doing it, why can't I, mm-hmm. you know? But trust me, we are eons away from the Standard H chair. You know what I mean? Like I'm too busy being interested in the designs that already exist in the world for me to actually think that mine are valuable enough to sell. So I'm not disillusioned quite yet, but I have designs on cool stuff, but again, I don't want to make a cheap version. It's going to have to be black walnut and it'll be several thousand dollars, you know, because that's what I like and that's what I want. And sampling a t-shirt is far less expensive than sampling furniture, you know? So even if I wanted to make it for myself as a sample, like, okay, so there's a suede jacket that I own, again, much like the Willys, can't buy it anymore. Eventually I would love to make this suede jacket for Standard H. I went to a very reputable company and threw out the idea of doing a collaboration because their stuff, their quality, their fabrics, it's insane. It's great. Not only are they not really interested in doing a collaboration, when I look at their retail and if they were to make it for me, I'm like, well, shit, I could literally make it for a third of that and it'll be my spec and my buttons and not theirs, mm-hmm. you know, or my zipper or whatever. So it's not that way in furniture. but so far the answer in short was no. There's not a product that I've thought of that doesn't apply. There's even other aspects of Standard H that like I would love to introduce to the brand that aren't even a product, it's a service.
Oh, interesting.
That I think would make a lot of sense, but I don't think the brand's big enough to make them financially viable from a profitability standpoint.
I'm intrigued to know what those are at some point.
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, well, travel.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't know. Maybe this podcast, I don't know. You guys tell me, if I created a trip, would you want to come on a trip with me?
Well, I can tell you, after looking at your Instagram stories over the past couple months, I'd want to go on that trip.
Well, that's very kind of you. That's something I've had in, like, ruminating for years. Like, because I have ideas, and honestly, like, I just toured the IWC factory. I just toured the MB&F factory. Like, that again, this isn't me gloating, but these are the kinds of trips that I think would be really rad to do through Standard H, like me orchestrating the flight. And I basically, I'd become a travel agent. You, customer, would just pay the money and show up effectively.
Yeah.
Like, you would book your own flight. You got to be there by a certain time. But the hotel, the travel, the food, every the reservations, everything would be taken care of. And that's not taken care of, meaning it's free, taken care of as in you don't have to worry about planning it.
Yep.
That's something that I absolutely want to do at some point. And for no more than 10 people at a time, because I don't want to travel with a zoo. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And ideally, probably cap it at 6.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like,
that'd be fun.
Honestly, but to be profitable and or worth it for me to do all of that, like, it's you're going to be spending more than you would spend on yourself. And that's where I'm kind of like, are we there yet? And if I'm wrong, let's do it, dude. Like, let's start next year. Like, let's go to an F1 race and tour a watch factory. Like, that's a Standard H vacation to me.
That would be epic.
And so if you guys want me to do that, by all means, I will do it in a heartbeat. But it can't cost me money, if that mm-hmm. makes sense.
Yep.
That's not why I'm in business. It's not charity out here.
Yeah.
You know?
Want to do cool stuff, but can't go broke doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Would there ever be a world where someone approached you and said, Wesley, I want to buy Standard H. Here's the check. Here's the number. Would you do it?
100%.
Really?
Yeah. So I think this is interesting as well, is that, you know, I think about how to build the business. I think about what I need to do differently going forward that I haven't done before. Like, before it was all about product.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all about, like, really working on the business. My CPA will tell you, if you're not making money, it's a hobby. It's not a business, right? So profitability is something that's important. Like, going back to, like, the travel idea. Like,
yeah.
If I'm not making money on orchestrating travel, as much as I like to travel, I can do that alone, and I'm a lot more nimble. You know, doing it in a group is only for the benefit of me wanting to sort of spread the cheer,
yeah,
if you will,
cheer the joy
of said trip, and that would be my motivation to do that, because I would love to share it. I just think it would be really fun, and I'm confident enough to provide a good time for others as the consummate host, right? But I also think about my family, and I think about, you know, building a life with my wife, and honestly, eventually in the near future, in the next few years, either my brand's going to have to take off somehow on its own based on the work that I've put in, or I'm going to need to take investment. Because not, and that's not because I'm money hungry. It's not because I can't do it. It's because there's more that I want to add to the collection. Mm-hmm. And to build out a whole collection, like, unless you're independently wealthy or have some sort of, like, trust fund, which I don't have, the only way to, like, build a collection, like a fashion collection, is to take an investment. And because you're going to spend anywhere from $60,000 to $100,000 a season building out a collection. You can, especially with, like, products and photo shoots and travel and lighting and background and... It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't have that kind of cash, which is why I can't grow the way that other brands that you see grow quickly, because they have investment, if not multiple investors. Now, there's part of me too that would, like, it wants that to happen, right? Like, I want that to happen. But on the same note, I'm kind of at a place too where, like, dude, I'm 45 this year. Like, in November, I will be 45. I could see myself working forever because I love doing what I'm doing. It's not about that. But there's like some security and, you know, if it's just me, I get to do whatever I want when I want, sure. But like there is something also where like if somebody wanted to buy my company and then just like retain me as like the creative director, dude, that would almost be kind of a dream scenario for me, just because it's like that's then doing and focusing on everything that I love. Like if I had enough investment to like hire an editor for my podcast and then we could finally do video and like all these kinds of things that I would love to do, which I've never really talked about. I've never really shared that. Yes, my podcast exists on YouTube, sure, but it's a static image. I would love to do video. I would love to be able to fly you, Brian, in for this interview and have us sit in a studio. And now the studio could be in my freaking garage. Like it doesn't need to have to be $1 million idea, but I can't afford to fly you in and have the lighting and have the editing. And because the only reason why I'm not on video right now is the fact that like, I don't want to add another thing to learn. Like,
yeah.
I've already learned how to edit audio. I don't need to learn how to edit video. I think I could get it quickly. I could probably do it. But anyway, my point being is taking investment and or somebody buying my company would allow all those dreams to come true in a much shorter time frame. So would I want that? Yeah. I mean, going back to my earlier statement of like the day you take investments, the day you start answering questions, like that's the stressor. And that's the reason I haven't done it, because I don't know. Like I just wish I would have the type of investor. Now, granted, call me a dreamer, because I am. But if this is unrealistic, I get it. But like, I would love to just have someone with the type of money that could be thrown at this company that's as passionate about the subjects that I'm passionate about, and that utterly sees what I've done and continues to trust that I will continue to do those and more creatively, because they're there. The ideas are there. The growth of Standard H is literally inhibited by nothing but money. And that's where I'm at. If you want to invest, great. Let's work together. I'm all about partnership. This podcast doesn't exist without partnership, right? But like, I don't know, man. Like, I just don't want the phone call every Friday. How are sales? How are sales? How are sales? It's like, you got to understand what we're building. You got to understand that it takes time.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm switching tracks again.
No, I love it. No, it's great.
So you've been in Southern California for a number of years now. When you come home, what's the first restaurant you're hitting?
I mean, it's always Bojangles, because it literally doesn't exist here. But I did see somewhere, I think LA is getting one, I think.
I saw that too.
Which is a problem, because I can make an excuse to going to Bojangles routinely when I go home. Like doing that routinely here, I'm going to be living in my large t-shirts. Yeah, I mean, it's usually Bojangles. Mellow Mushroom is a pizza. Pizza's my favorite food. Like, and I love Neapolitan style. I love New York style. I just love pizza, right? Sex, golf, and pizza. Doesn't have to be good to enjoy it, right? And it's like, that's just it, you know? Those are probably the two. And then usually, like, I don't know. I always like to try new places, too. And God knows, like Charlotte and Raleigh and even Winston-Salem. Mm-hmm. There's always something new popping up, which is cool. And then let alone the brewery scene, you know, like going to Asheville and drinking some amazing beer, and like Foothills Brewing, shout out to them, because they're making two of my favorite IPAs. Anyway, I'm trying to cut back on beer, to be honest, but like as I sip my Negroni.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not beer.
Yeah. Well, it isn't.
Yeah. So that leads me to another question, because I literally had this written down.
Okay.
Bojangles or In-N-Out? Pick one.
Oh, geez. Bojangles or In-N-Out? Well, honestly, like I love breakfast. I'd eat breakfast 24 hours a day. So I'm going Bojangles.
Nice.
Because I don't eat the chicken at Bojangles.
Really?
Exactly. That your facial expression is exactly what I thought I would receive. It's sausage and egg biscuit with the Beau Rounds. That's my order.
Oh my gosh. That's blasphemy.
I mean, the chicken's delicious, but like, there's a lot of good chicken out there. For whatever reason, sure. That biscuit and that sausage patty is like, it's ridiculous.
Man, I thought for sure you were going to say Cajun filet.
It's very good. But my problem, here's the thing. Here's my problem with chicken, like a biscuit situation, is that the breading isn't consistent. The chicken to breading isn't consistent. Sometimes it's a thinner version of it. And like, you're like, oh, well, this is just breaded. Like, this is just fried stuff that I'm eating now. There's no meat. The sausage is the same every time.
That's true.
So again, back to quality, right? Consistency is a major function of quality to me. If you're inconsistent, it's not great quality, especially when it comes to a restaurant. It's becoming a food podcast. That's a good point. Like this. Let's keep it going.
Okay. So I only had one other question written down on mine, and this is something I've heard other people ask. Mm-hmm. Is there something that I have not asked that you wish I had?
Well, no, because I think we've done a good job of talking about things I've never really talked about before, which is rare because I've done 130 episodes of my podcast. Now, granted, I'm not the guest, so to be fair, there's that. Yeah, I can't think of any questions that I wish you had asked. Like, we do these things blind, right? Like, I do my own show blind-ish, you know, 90% of the time. And yeah. We had no dialogue about doing this aside from, oh, you want to interview me? That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry it took 6 months to do it. You know what I mean? Like that was our dialogue, is me apologizing and us actually recording. So no, like I had zero expectations coming into it. So I can't really say that there's, why didn't you ask me this? You know what I mean? I'm good. Or do you have other questions, or is this it?
That was it, man. Snap. That's all I had. Okay.
All right. Well, cool. Yeah. I was that was the other thing. I was like, I don't know how long this is gonna take, you know. So
yeah.
But this was a great time. Thank you, man. Like, this was really cool.
Absolutely.
I actually enjoy sharing the stories and the whys, because that is me as a person, quite frankly. Like, I always want to know why. Probably drives my wife nuts. But it's, I don't know. Like, I just, there's a reason why I do everything that I do. And if there's anything else to convey, or if there's nothing else that I would convey in this conversation, is if you want to know the why behind something, I can tell you the why, because there is one. And I'm kind of proud of that, because there's a lot of brands, I'm sure, that have very poor reasons as to why they do certain things, other than we thought it would sell well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, because the Avant T is the result of your why.
Totally.
So for all of the products on your
website. And had no idea if it would sell or not.
Yeah. So that's an excellent point. If you see Wesley, ask him why.
Sure, but by all means, I would love to tell you why. It's just me trying to create cool shit for cool people that's made well and that's consistent. Mm-hmm. And you could file under the buy less, buy better category.
Yep.
I'm not asking you to buy 7 in Blue Scudo. I'm asking you to buy 1. And I hope you enjoy the hell out of it. You know,
yeah,
that's it.
Love it. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate you answering the questions, because
dude, this was so fun. Thanks. And it blew by. I can't believe it's been an hour plus. Okay. Before we go though, actually, you're not getting off scot-free.
Oh no.
I want you to share your IWC experience that you just got home from, because you deserve as much shine as humanly possible. Tell me about the opening. Tell me about what you did while you were there. And you, this, not the Cliffs Notes. Let's hear it.
Okay. No, I appreciate it. Yeah. So IWC reached out. Well, if you hadn't seen it on Instagram, IWC relaunched their New York City flagship boutique off Madison Avenue. And as part of that, they flew me up to illustrate, do live painting at the event. And ahead of time, I spoke with their event coordinator. She had just come from the UK Post. I'm thinking the London Post. And so she was setting this whole thing up. And I want to say it was probably about a month ago that she did the initial reach out. And we kind of talked about what it could look like and what was going to happen. And we ultimately settled on doing gifts for people. So ahead of time, I don't think I have anything here to show. Ahead of time.
Back right over your shoulder.
Yes. Thank you.
I saw that back there. I've been meaning to ask you about it.
Yes. So I painted all four of the new Portugieser perpetual chronographs. So we've got the silver background. We've got the onyx background, which in the metal, that is amazing.
That's my favorite one.
It was this one, the silver, no, the blue sky.
It's the blue. It's the white gold case.
Yes. This one was, I think, everyone's favorite when they were at the event. A lot of people were talking about that one.
Interesting.
And then the last one, which is the dune, which is also incredible.
It's like a champagne color.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, really. That one plays with the light more than any of them. So they asked me to paint those four watches ahead of time. And so I did that. And then we had prints made. So I think we had close to 250 prints made. Those are still at the boutique. So if you're up in New York City, go up there and ask Mariana or any of the sales associates for a print. I'm sure they'll give you one.
Wait, hold on. So you painted it live, and then what? They just like scanned it on site and started printing them?
No, sorry. I should have clarified. So the weeks leading up to the event, I painted those four watches, had prints made, brought them with me to New York. But while I was there, I was illustrating the Eternal calendar.
Okay, I was like, you were painting live. I saw the footage.
Yes. Yes. So I kind of did my sketch ahead of time, brought all my supplies, got everything all posted up. They had me in a cool little spot. So if you go check out the new IWC boutique, they have a giant coffee bar. I think it's coffee that you can only get at the IWC boutique.
It's so sick.
But to the right of that, there's a little nook area that I was posted up at where I was doing my illustrations. They had a DJ posted up at the front. She was doing a great job. They had a watchmaker over by one side, so you could watch him assemble, disassemble watches. Jean Rousseau had a whole little station where they were letting people customize straps while
they were there. I thought they were there. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, really cool.
Amazing.
And so I think that was all the posts of stuff that was happening. But yeah, so I started painting at, I want to say, 6:15. And so I was kind of bopping in and did my wash, talking to people. And then I jump back into it and kind of did some more illustration. So if you want, go check out. I have a time lapse on my Instagram.
Yeah.
Of the whole event, me getting there and setting up and everything, and then actually doing the painting. But it was really fun. It was it wasn't open to the public. It was invite only. But met a bunch of industry people, journalists, as well as other brand reps. A lot of people from Mercedes. I know that's a big partnership with IWC. So that was really cool getting to meet a lot of people, see a lot of faces that I've seen on Instagram. Ben's Watches was there.
Cool.
I'm going to leave Blake Bettner.
Yep.
A bunch of people were there. So it was really fun getting to see a lot of familiar faces and then also meet a lot of new interesting people. So anyway, amazing. Yeah, we shut down the event at 9 and packed up. And I think I was back in my hotel room by 10:30, passed out, woke up the next day, went to Watches of Switzerland, saw my my buddy Richard, got to try on a bunch of new watches other than IWC, and then jumped on an airplane and was headed back home to Raleigh. I think, yeah, I was there for just about 24 hours. So,
oh, that's sick. Oh man, that's the best, man. That is the best. I'm so glad. It sounds like you had a blast, and as I expected, that's amazing, man.
Yeah.
Well,
it was a lot of fun.
Brian, thanks again. This made for a very fun sort of detour on the pit stop, I guess. This will come out on Tuesday, so I'm excited for that. Nice. And I really appreciate you taking the time and showing the interest, man. And great questions. Yeah, like I said, I mean, it was fun to share some additional things that I've never talked about before. So
Well, this is, I appreciate you opening up because I know it's not easy being on the receiving end of the questions.
Oh, man. I'm ready for it. I'm always ready. You know, I think it's because I've done it so much to others that it's like it's mm-hmm. only fair for it.
Yeah.
For it to yeah.
And no one knows that story better than you, so it's easy to tell it sometimes.
That's true. You know, that's something that's a line that I often use when people are like, was there anything I need to prepare for? Or like, are there any questions you can send me? I'm like, no, you're not getting the questions ahead of time because I don't know what the questions are necessarily. And oh, by the way, if you don't know your own story, then we're both in trouble. You know, that's literally what I tell people all the time. So
exactly.
Great, dude. Well, awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for letting me ask the questions, man. This is fun.
Okay. We'll see you soon. This wraps up this episode of the Standard H Podcast. If you like what you heard, I'd love it if you'd share it with a friend or two. And if you have a moment, please rate and review the show as it helps others discover these episodes. It absolutely helps far more than you realize. Shout out to Jensen Reed and Super Beautiful for the theme track. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you in the next one. Take care.